President Trump met with King Abdullah of Jordan.
The Palestinians, along with Jordan, Egypt, and various other countries, have rejected Trump's plan to forcibly relocate an estimated 1.9 million Gaza residents.
Famine in the Darfur region of Sudan.
I swear, what is happening in Zamzam is devastating. Explosions have turned citizens into corpses. No money and no food.
And President Trump has suspended enforcement of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Which basically does two things. First, it prohibits the bribery of foreign government officials. And second, it ensures that companies, particularly public companies, maintain accurate books and records.
Today is Wednesday, February 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish. We begin today's show in Washington, but the news is all about the Middle East. Jordan's King Abdullah II was at the White House on Tuesday as President Donald Trump threatened to cut aid to Jordan and Egypt if they refuse his demand to permanently take in most of the Palestinians from Gaza as part of his plan to redevelop the territory. He also warned that if Hamas did not release all the remaining hostages by 12 o'clock on Saturday, the ceasefire deal with Israel should be canceled. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has our story.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip fear the return of war after Hamas's threat to delay the next planned release of Israeli hostages and U.S. President Donald Trump's call to cancel the ceasefire. As he hosted Jordan's King Abdullah II at the White House Tuesday, Trump doubled down on his plan to take over Gaza.
I think it's going to be something that's going to be magnificent for the Palestinians. They're going to be in love with it. I did very well with real estate. I can tell you about real estate. They're going to be in love with it.
The Palestinians, along with Jordan, Egypt, and various other countries, have rejected Trump's plan to forcibly relocate an estimated 1.9 million Gaza residents into neighboring countries. But other than saying he would immediately receive 2,000 children in Gaza sick with cancer and other illnesses, King Abdullah declined Trump's invitation to share his counteroffer.
I think we have to keep in mind that there is a plan from Egypt and the Arab countries. We're being invited by Mohammed bin Salman to discussions in Riyadh. I think the point is how do we make this work in a way that is good for everybody?
It's a high-stakes meeting for Abdullah, who must maintain ties with a key ally whom Jordan depends on for foreign assistance. Trump hinted Monday he would withhold aid, but backtracked on Tuesday. Many Jordanians are descendants of displaced Palestinians. If Abdullah supports Trump's plans, it will create major political and economic problems and allow Hamas to enter, says Gaith Al-Omari of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Hamas could create not only domestic problems in terms of terror, but also there's a fear that Jordan might then become a staging ground for attacks on Israel. All of these things will create very, very severe threats to Jordan's stability and maybe even survival.
Al-Omari said Trump's takeover plan removes the incentive for Hamas to continue the ceasefire. On Monday, the U.S.-designated terror group threatened to delay the next planned release of hostages, alleging Israeli truce violations. Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responded with the same ultimatum.
The decision I passed unanimously in the cabinet is this. If Hamas does not return our hostages by Saturday noon, the ceasefire will end, and the IDF will return to intense fighting until Hamas is finally defeated.
Israel will hand over Gaza to the U.S. after the war, Trump has said.
We're not going to buy anything. We're going to have it, and we're going to keep it, and we're going to make sure that there's going to be peace, and there's not going to be any problem, and nobody's going to question it.
These Gazans would disagree. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
In a related story, UNRWA, the UN agency that provides aid to Palestinian refugees, is still operating in East Jerusalem, even though Israel's ban on the agency went into effect last week. Refugee advocates are proposing alternatives to help hundreds of Palestinian children whose educations and futures are uncertain. Amy Gutman reports from East Jerusalem.
Children are back in class in East Jerusalem's Shofat refugee camp, where schools are run by UNRWA, the UN aid agency that supports Palestinian refugees. Israel banned the agency at the end of January amid questions about its neutrality. Since then, international UNRWA staff have relocated to Jordan, while local employees continue to work at the schools and health clinics.
The children, the parents, The patients, the medical staff have been left in this situation, as have we as an entire organization, of literally not knowing what's going to happen.
Israel did not renew Fowler's visa and those of other international UNRWA staff.
While the ban on UNRWA covers East Jerusalem, it does not affect the agency's operations in the West Bank and Gaza, areas not considered Israeli territory.
The ban follows Israeli allegations that some UNRWA staff members were involved in the October 7th attack. Israel says UNRWA infrastructure has been repeatedly used for terror. The IDF released a video that appears to show Hamas terrorists near UN vehicles and a logistics warehouse in Rafah. U.S. President Donald Trump has signed an order barring U.S. funding of UNRWA, and European Parliament members from 14 countries have also called for UNRWA to be shut down for a lack of neutrality. Jerusalem city officials say a new center with classrooms and medical clinics is set to open later this year. Meanwhile, students are welcome to transfer to other schools in East Jerusalem. Advocates like Margus Scheff say a different agency should continue the services.
The option now that it's available for others to take over education in Gaza needs to be seized. A reformed Palestinian curriculum, which is actually available, needs to be taught, and it needs to be taught by people of good faith.
But others reject the idea.
At the Shofat camp, Dr. Salim Anati, who retired from his role running UNRWA's health clinic in 2020, rejects any alternative.
Nobody can do what UNRWA has done.
Although the ban is in effect and UNRWA continues to work, it is clear to many that it's not business as usual. Amy Gutman for VOA News, Jerusalem.
In the Sudanese civil war, the violence continues and the humanitarian conditions worsen. The UN has declared a famine in at least five areas of Sudan where it says people are dying daily from starvation and related illnesses. One of those areas includes the besieged Zamzam displacement camp in North Darfur. Reporter Henry Wilkins spoke to refugees who fled the camp.
This man arrived at the refugee site at Chad's border with Sudan 2 days earlier. After making a perilous 340-kilometer journey on foot from the Zamzam displacement camp in North Darfur. The camp is gripped by famine and besieged by the hostile Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The man asked to remain anonymous for security reasons.
I swear, what is happening in Zamzam is devastating. Explosions have turned citizens into corpses. No money and no food. Sometimes you go the whole day eating only one meal.
He recounted how he and other members of the community in Zamzam had to bury 25 infants who had died of starvation. According to the UN, parts of Darfur are in a state of famine, the world's first in 7 years, including the Zamzam camp. Aid groups and residents say the camp of 300,000 inhabitants is also being regularly shelled by the RSF, one of the warring parties in Sudan's civil war that evolved from the Janjaweed militia. Another Zamzam resident who fled to Chad also asked to remain anonymous for fear of reprisals.
When we first arrived, we thought it would be safe because humanitarian organizations were based there. We assumed the Janjaweed wouldn't attack them, but they did.
He said the young and the elderly were the first to perish.
The elderly and children were the most vulnerable. Many families lost their young ones due to malnutrition and lack of medical care.
The UN's World Food Programme says the famine stems from conflict. Lenny Kinsley is head of communications for the World Food Programme in Sudan.
I think the main point is, you know, this is a man-made conflict, and the famine as a result is also man-made. And the solution can only be man-made. A humanitarian pause would be required to ramp up to the scale that's needed to prevent this from really becoming one of the world's worst hunger or famine situations in decades.
As the UN continues to distribute food for the refugees here in Chad, it says the famine in Darfur is expected to spread to five more regions of Sudan by mid-2025. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre, Chad.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Officials in Gabon say the country's magistrate courts are effectively closed because the officials who run them are on strike due to poor working conditions and pay. The angry magistrates are rejecting pleas by Gabon's leaders to return to work while waiting for conditions to improve. Nearly 100 people were killed and up to 60 others wounded when members of the Islamic State terror group launched a deadly attack on a military base belonging to security forces from Somalia's Puntland region, officials said on Tuesday. Chilean authorities issued two evacuation alerts for the southern region of La Araucanía as wildfires raged. At least one person there has died. The country's government said the move aims to protect more than 860,000 people. La Araucanía, south of the capital Santiago, has faced a wave of forest fires that have spread rapidly due to high temperatures, strong winds, and drought. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. On Monday night in Washington, President Trump signed an executive order directing the Department of Justice not to enforce the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act for 180 days. So what exactly is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and why might the president want it to go away? To find out, I spoke with Jessica Tillotman. She's the Associate Dean for Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School.
The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or FCPA, has been around since 1977. It was created in the wake of what's known as the Watergate scandal, and this involved former President Nixon. So in the wake of the scandal, there was a big investigation, and they discovered that defense contractors and oil and gas companies were going around the world and bribing foreign officials in order to obtain business. So in response, Congress created the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which basically does two things. First, it prohibits the bribery of foreign government officials. And second, it ensures that companies, particularly public companies, maintain accurate books and records and robust internal controls to ensure that, they're not paying bribes or any other types of illicit payments.
So why does the American government care if an American company is bribing officials overseas?
I think the reason why Congress cared so much about foreign bribery was for a variety of reasons. First of all, it wanted to make sure that American companies, or otherwise companies subject to its jurisdiction, maintained honest books and records. And that's particularly because this applies to public companies, but also wanted to make sure that, you know, U.S. companies weren't going around the world and bribing officials. If they shouldn't be doing it in the United States, they shouldn't be doing it abroad. The other part about it was that it would play a role in trying to kind of combat the global scourge of corruption.
Now, on Monday night, in President Trump's executive order, he said that the FCPA is stymieing economic development. Presumably, this means that it's preventing these American companies from doing what they need to do to grow to their full potential. Am I right?
That is President Trump's argument. I do think that there can be a debate about whether or not that actually is a reflection of the current business environment. We know that in certain higher risk jurisdictions that it is difficult. It's a difficult environment for many businesses to operate because of the demand for corruption by corrupt government officials. However, when the FCPA was created in the late 70s and we started to see a ramp up of enforcement around 2004 in the wake of 9/11, and we started to see a very, very much a change in behavior. By 2008, 2010 and beyond, we were seeing household names settling these enforcement actions, and that generally had the impact of changing corporate behavior abroad. And frankly, most companies recognize that bribery isn't good for business. It is not tax deductible. It's expensive. Oftentimes, corrupt officials that ask for a bribe once keep coming back and ask for more bribes. So I think even though it was a difficult transition initially for companies to understand how to participate in the global marketplace with laws like this, companies have really changed.
So on Monday night, Trump signed this executive order directing the Department of Justice to stop enforcing this for 180 days. He didn't repeal the law, but he's suspending its enforcement. Do you take that as a signal that these foreign bribes are things he wants to see, or things that might be happening below the surface that he wants to allow to happen?
That's a really good question. He's been on record of saying that he thinks the FCPA is a horrible law. And frankly, it's unclear why he personally may have an interest in not seeing this law enforced. And I wouldn't want to speculate as to what that is about. But I will say this, the 180-day pause, I think, was a shock. I think a lot of us expected that there might be some again, tweaking at the margins, or that there might be a more narrowed focus. But a 180-day pause really has made many anti-corruption experts, and myself included, very nervous, because that's a 6-month stopping of enforcing law when there are many active investigations going on right now, many active investigations that involve global partners around the world. That's part of it. It also allows the DOJ to basically renew this 180-day pause if it thinks it's necessary, meaning it could go on for another 180 days or another 6 months. And there is some concern that there is a recognition by the current administration that this is a statutory mandate, so that they can't just kill the FCPA because it's based in statute, but that they are engaging in these sustained pauses, or for a sustained pause of 6 months or even longer, because they are trying to get around enforcing the law.
So in your opinion, then, without the FCPA, would corruption increase?
That's a great question. I think that it is unlikely that you will see corporations, particularly large corporations with well-established corporate compliance programs, significantly changing course. You know, I think they've already invested heavily over the past two decades in anti-corruption compliance programs within their companies. And they also recognize the value of having a clean business. And again, it's a different world than when this law was passed. They also have to appreciate that there are foreign entities, you know, you have foreign governments around the world that have ramped up their own foreign bribery enforcement that they still have to be wary of if they're a multinational company. Do I think that corporations will be less inclined to disclose violations that they've discovered? Absolutely. Do I think it emboldens corrupt officials? Absolutely. I think that this is sending a signal around the world that if corrupt officials want to demand bribes, that now you have companies really can't point to the FCPA as some sort of reason to say no, and it puts them in a tougher position.
Jessica Tillotman is the Associate Dean for Government Procurement Law, and she's a distinguished professional lecturer in government contracts law, practice, and policy at the George Washington University Law School. Professor Tillotman, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
On Tuesday, Europe said it would ease regulations on artificial intelligence, making the announcement at a major AI summit in Paris that brought together global tech giants and politicians. But some experts see bigger challenges stalling the bloc's ambitions to be an AI heavyweight, from the need to pool resources to attracting more investment and talent. Lisa Bryant reports.
After U.S. President Donald Trump's new and massive Stargate investment project and China's DeepSeek startup, Europe wants to get a share of the artificial intelligence pie. Among other announcements at the Paris summit, co-host French President Emmanuel Macron outlined plans for $113 billion in private AI investment. The two-day summit underscored tensions between fears of too much AI regulation and not enough. Here's U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance, who is making his first overseas trip to Europe.
Now, at this moment, we face the extraordinary prospect of a new industrial revolution, one on par with the invention of the steam engine or Bessemer steel. But it will never come to pass if overregulation deters innovators from taking the risks necessary to advance the ball.
Macron, who's been nicknamed France's startup president, outlined caveats.
Nous avons besoin, comme on l'a fait durant ce sommet,
Macron said, alongside acceleration and innovation in AI, the industry needs rules to move forward. Right now, Europe's AI industry lags far behind those of the U.S. and China. But the right policy, some experts believe, can help close the gap.
Europe really has pretty much everything else it needs to lead in AI or in, you know, other complex technologies. The talent is absolutely incredible. The size of the European economy, the scale of the European economy is also huge. The education system, essentially, we see a wind of change in the EU, really led by France, and Emmanuel Macron is very, very much behind that.
Pierre-Alexandre Balland is chief data scientist at the Center for European Policy Studies in Brussels. Beyond easing EU regulations, he sees bigger challenges, like pooling European research and other resources, or calls for investing pension funds to finance AI's growth and to concentrate on a single AI hub in Europe, in Paris. Alicia Garcia Herrero, senior fellow at Brussels-based Bruegel Policy Institute, agrees France is leading the way. She believes Europe should narrow its goals, focusing on areas like AI applications for robotics.
Can AI make the EU more competitive? No doubt. But I think there's many other issues that need to be solved beyond AI. The most important one is having a single market.
Paris summit organizers have also pushed for commitments on making AI more ethical, accessible, and environmentally sustainable. Lisa Bryant, VOA News.
As we've reported here before, last month, the Trump administration paused funding for the U.S. Agency for International Development amid reports that it may be put under State Department control as the president seeks to align it with his America First policy. Britain's recent similar move to restructure its foreign aid could offer lessons for Washington. Henry Ridgewell has that story from London.
The battle over the future of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, echoes a similar debate in Britain. In 2020, then Prime Minister Boris Johnson merged the Department for International Development, or DFID, with the Foreign Office.
This will unite our aid with our diplomacy and bring them together in our international effort. The Foreign Secretary will be empowered to decide which countries receive or cease to receive British aid while delivering a single UK strategy for each country.
Johnson's decision chimed with his Conservative Party's scepticism over aid spending, says analyst Tim Durrant of the Institute for Government.
Not always kind of aligned with what he thought the UK's foreign policy priorities should be. I think there was definitely a sense among those on the right of UK politics that DFID was kind of, you know, a bit too big for its boots perhaps, or needed better oversight.
But the move shocked the aid sector, says analyst Mark Miller of ODI Global.
Because you now had a set of senior managers in place who were largely focused on supporting the UK's national interest, however you might interpret that, rather than previously a very clear mandate where aid was meant to be prioritised towards poverty reduction.
In 2020, Britain's aid spending was also cut from 0.7% of gross national income, the highest in the G7 group of developed nations, to 0.5%. Spending was redirected. Almost a third of Britain's aid budget, some $5.2 billion, was spent on supporting refugees inside the country in 2023. Aid spending also reflected Britain's geopolitical priorities, says Miller.
There was more attention being paid to trying to outcompete, let's say, China or Russia, particularly in Asia Pacific, trying to upscale investment in these regions where historically aid had been much more focused on Africa.
The creation of Britain's Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, or FCDO, offers lessons for Washington as it mulls the future of USAID, says Durrant.
In the UK instance, there was a sort of reputational hit. DFID had a very strong brand, as does USAID. There's also the kind of knock-on impact it has on morale and productivity. I think this is particularly going to be a case in the US. But there is now a sense that the FCDO is the sort of the one voice, and that there are people who have both development and diplomacy experience who are representing the UK. In countries where the UK is spending development money.
Durrant added that strong oversight of spending is vital to retaining public support for foreign aid. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.